I recognize a little twang in Taylor's voice. Why is he covering for me? I don't want anyone getting in trouble on my behalf. By the time I arrive at the bar, Taylor's already there, swapping out the menus. I am so sorry about that. I thought they were all the same. I can't get the apology out fast enough. Don't worry about it. He gives me a grin. Nothing at SSE is ever done simply. There are always a dozen versions of every party element, and each is more expensive than the next. If whatever you're working on seems straightforward, you're probably doing something wrong. He gestures to the kids' bar menus that are stacked in his arms. Want to help me switch these out? Of course. I grab half a stack of frames from him, and we start to make our way out of the tent through the crowds of guests that are already deep into the party spirit. I'm so grateful for his kindness. McKenna has brought me to near tears for far lesser offenses. You didn't have to take the bullet, you know. Quaid might have gotten upset with you, and she's already pretty scary under normal circumstances. When I glance over, he's looking at me like the notion is ridiculous. Don't worry. I haven't met a woman yet who could ever stay mad at me for long. I'll bet, I grumble under my breath at his bravado, and his smile stretches to reveal one perfect dimple. I'm running our conversation over in my head when he starts talking again. You'll see. I stop short. You mentioned that nothing is ever the simplest choice. Does that include the guestbook pens? I'm so nervous. He looks bemused. There should have been 8 of them. They were Mont Blanc, each had a different inscription. Oh, Lord! I quickly hand him my stack of frames. I just grabbed a handful of blue Bics from the production kit. I screech and hurry to correct the problem, hopefully before anyone on staff notices. The sound of Taylor's laughter follows me all the way out of the tent. The next day, I don't open my eyes until well past 11. I never sleep that late. But I didn't get home from the mitzvah until after 2, and I'm exhausted. I sit up and let my legs dangle over the side of the bed and stretch them to ease some of the tension. You'd think that years of hauling gigantic trays of ribs through a restaurant would have prepared my body for one night spent working an event. But you'd be wrong. I hurt in places I didn't even know existed. Once I stepped into that tent yesterday, I didn't sit down until I got into my car to drive home. 10 hours of hurrying back and forth through the party, pulling props and setting up the guest favors, moving 450 gift bags after Selah didn't like their first location, and then assisting with wrap-up at the end of the night, I'm pretty sure I've burned off the calorie equivalent of 5 Zumba classes. The night had been exhausting, but it was also fast-paced and exciting. I learned so much about how the SSE team lays out a timeline and how they constantly troubleshoot to keep the event as on time as possible. Watching everyone move behind the scenes like a well-oiled machine made me realize for the first time how much work is actually required to make something look so flawless and simple. I stand up and stretch out my whole body, then go out to the kitchen in search of a cup of coffee the size of my head. Max is sitting on the kitchen countertop, eating a giant bowl of what looks like hamster food, so I'm guessing it's some sort of diety cereal. She's wearing an old flannel button-down, underwear, a pair of UGG boots, and nothing else. What is with this girl in pants? What is it with you in pants? I ask quizzically. Said the cheerleader. Max scowls at my pink boy shorts and the baby tee I got at cheer camp in freshman year of high school. Touché. I smile in spite of myself and head towards the coffee maker only to find that there's a fresh pot waiting for me. I take back the pants comment. You can walk around here nude if you're willing to make me coffee. I joyfully pour myself a cup, add 2 Splendas and a little of the milk that's sitting next to Max on the counter. Max just grumbles into her cereal bowl in response. She's clearly not a morning person. Well, actually, it's almost noon, so technically she's not a mid-morning person either. I wonder if there's any time of day when she's not grouchy. I smile down into my coffee as I take a sip. Probably not. Doing anything fun today? I ask happily. You're looking at it. She points to the cabinet behind my head without moving from her perch. Can you hand me a mug? I'll get it. How do you take it? Black. Of course. I pour her a cup and hand it over. I need to go shopping today for work clothes. Can you tell me where to find a Forever 21 or an H&M or something? I grab a bowl from the cabinet behind me and pour myself some of her brand-filled cereal. She looks briefly affronted at my thievery, but chooses to let it go. Hollywood and Highland is the closest, but it's filled with douchey tourists and sweaty guys in Avengers costumes. You should go to the Grove. That's on Fairfax, right? I ask before swallowing a spoonful. My taste buds openly revolt against the amount of flax packed into each flake. I fight the urge to spit it back out. Instead, I put the bowl down on the counter behind me and hope she doesn't notice that I've stopped eating it. Fairfax and Third. She jumps down from the counter, flashing her Star Wars panties. I can take you if you want. Really? I can't keep the shock out of my voice. You want to hang out with me? You're not too busy? Calm down. I don't want to take a blood oath or anything. I need a break. I studied for 6 hours yesterday. If I have to look at another textbook, I'll scrape my eyes out with this spoon. She holds up the spoon from her cereal bowl and then turns to put them both in the dishwasher. What textbook? What are you studying? I'm confused. This is news to me. I'm in the last year of my master's at UCLA. She responds, transferring a few dirty dishes from the sink to the dishwasher. At first, I'm dumbstruck, and then I'm unnaturally proud of her. You're getting your master's? That's so great. I had no idea. Why didn't you tell me? Max closes the dishwasher. You never asked. She gives me a nonchalant shrug and turns to leave the kitchen. It's only then that I see the words stamped across the underwear on her bum. These are not the droids you seek. This girl is so weird. I jump off the counter and follow her to get dressed. Chapter 7. The next morning, I head into the office, and for the first time, I don't stick out like a sore thumb. With Max's help, I have acquired a new wardrobe in only one color. It's harder than you'd think to maintain my own personal style without color involved, but after hitting several stores, having the glass of wine Max insisted was necessary to deal with the Grove on a Sunday, and finding a clearance rack at Banana, I found a ton of stuff to mix and match. Today, I have on a gingham black and white button-down tucked into black skinny jeans with black wedge booties and a black cardigan. My necklace is gold, with red chevrons hanging just below the collar of my blouse. Yes, technically that's color, but nobody said anything about accessories being black. At least, this is the case I plan to make if anyone says anything. My hair is styled in bouncy waves, and my makeup is pretty and polished. I realize I'm still dressed a lot peppier than anyone else at SSC, but well, while you can take the girl out of Texas. In the little office, McKenna is already tapping away at his laptop, and I sit down in my corner seat and fire up my old Mac. Have you worked a phone before? McKenna asks out of nowhere. A phone? Yes, I'm not a monkey. But that thing in front of him looks more like mission control than a telephone. No, but I'm sure I can figure it out, I say, staring warily at the millions of buttons. Let me show you quickly. He gestures impatiently for me to come over, and I hop up. Okay, this is the call log. He opens up a program on his computer screen that looks like the inner workings of the Pentagon. There are names and numbers and notations and dates and times. How does he even keep all this straight? If someone calls and Sayla is unavailable, just put their info here, he says, using a cursor to show me a new line entry in the program. You hit this button to answer. The phone buzzes as if on cue. He hits the answer button in question and speaks into his mouthpiece. Sayla Smith's office? Yes. Hello, Maya. How are you? Great. Good. No, unfortunately, she's out of the office. Can I have her return? On cell? Great. We'll buzz you later. He types the info into the call sheet. And that button, he continues right along, is to end the call. This is to transfer. Just remember to dial 1 first. This button is to connect someone on a conference. I keep nodding like I have any idea what he's talking about. Just hit conference, dial the number, then hit conference again to connect. Got it? Got it. I so don't got it. Great. I'm going to get a coffee. Cover the phones. He pulls off the headset and holds it out to me. I recoil like he's offering me crack. I'm not really sure I can. Jesus, Alabama, you can either do this job or you can't. Which is it? He demands. I bite my lower lip nervously. Can. I grab the headset and put it on with more aggression than necessary, as if jamming it on my head with brute force proves to him that I'm more capable than I actually am. He's already out the office door before I even sit down in his chair. I stare at the open call log in front of me. I guess I can just write things down on post-its until he gets back. Or maybe no one will even call. Maybe I'll just sit here silently until he gets back. No harm, no foul. The phone buzzes and instantly my stomach fills with acid. I hit answer. Selah Smith's office. This is Brinkley. How may I help you? I stutter. Wow, who let you answer the phone? Ambrose asks rudely. What can I do for you? I try and sound as rude as she does. Where's McKenna? Getting coffee? May I help you with something? No, I'll ask him. In the meantime, answer the phone the way he does. If you recite that monologue each time the phone rings, you'll never get to all your calls. Okay, thanks. Before I even finish the sentence, the line goes dead. I hit N just to make sure it's hung up, and it immediately buzzes again. Selah Smith's office, I say brightly. It's Dawn. Is she available? A woman asks. I'm so sorry. She is unavailable. Can I just tell her I called? She hangs up with a click before I can get her last name or number. Shoot. The phone buzzes again. Selah Smith's office. The phone buzzes again and two lines light up. Hi, Quaid. It's Billy from Superior. Is she available? Hi, Billy. This is actually... Line three buzzes. You know what, Billy? Can I just put you on hold for one moment? I'm staring at two blinking, unanswered lines. Sure thing, he says. One second. I push the button to put Billy on hold and accidentally hang up on him. No! I hit the button for line two. Selah Smith's office, can you please hold a moment? I put them on hold before they even answer. This time I actually do it right. I hit line three. Selah Smith's office, I have Michael Field calling. She's unavailable. Can I take a message? I ask hurriedly. Have her return here to the office, she says and hangs up. Man, I hope we have these numbers saved in contact somewhere. I push the button for line two, and line one buzzes again, and then line three does too. Sorry about that, I tell line two. No problem. Is she available? A man asks. She's just... The other three lines keep buzzing at me, angry. I panic. I am so sorry. Can I just put you on hold right quick? Darn it, my accent always sneaks up when I'm nervous. Sure, he says. I hit hold. Selah Smith's office, please hold, I say to line three, then put them on hold. Selah Smith's office, please hold, I say to line four, then put them on hold. Selah Smith's office, I say to one finally. The phone breaks up in a garble, and I can barely make out the woman's voice on the other end. I'm so sorry, your phone is breaking up. I raise my voice a little. Her heavily accented voice barely breaks through to my end. Line three hangs up. Lines two and four are still blinking. Crap. I apologize, miss, but I cannot understand you. Your phone is breaking up, I say louder. She says again. I'm sorry, who? I'm almost yelling now. Lana Cruz, can you hear me? I need to speak with Selah. Her voice suddenly comes in loud and clear, and I instantly realize I'm speaking with the gorgeous Spanish actress I've seen in a dozen movies. And I've just yelled at her on the phone. Crap. Hi, Miss Cruz. I'm so sorry. She's out of the office. Can I have her return? I try and sound professional, but my voice is shaking. I've never talked to an Oscar winner before. Yes, she has the number. She hangs up just as line four drops off. Line two still blinks. I hit the button for it. I am so sorry about that. How can I help you? I'm guessing this is Brinkley, he says dryly. Who in the world would know my name? And why would you guess that? I ask nervously. Neither of the other two assistants would have let me sit on hold for 5 minutes. He sounds annoyed, and I have the strongest urge to accidentally hang up on him. I eye the other lines, hoping one of them will buzz and save me. It is Brinkley, and I beg your pardon. It's my first time on the phones, and I'm not... Well, gosh, you don't have time to listen to me. No, I'm afraid I don't. Cue flop sweat. Right, of course. She's actually out of the office, though. Can I take a message, Mr. Ashton? Just tell her I called, please. It's him. I wish that I'd stop making an idiot of myself in front of this person. Whatever their relationship, he obviously has Selah's ear, and her hearing about what a moron I am doesn't really bode well for my career. It takes a real effort to get myself in check, but I do. I will. And I'm sorry, again, Mr. Ashton, I'll tell her you called. Thanks. The line goes dead. Well, that was interesting. The next month flies by so quickly I barely notice. By mid-November, I'm working at least 60 hours a week, and I've helped SSE with 6 events, so I feel like I've officially been jumped into their gang. It's easier now to anticipate what McKenna and Quaid expect from me, and to steer clear of Selah's mood swings. I can handle the phones now, too, though I still really hate to do it since I'm positive I'll destroy the whole infrastructure with one misplaced phone message. And teacher's pet or not, after that first event, I sort of became an assistant for the entire office. I'm not sure if this is because people like me now or because they know I'll do anything they ask, but I don't care because it means I'm constantly doing several projects at once, and I love it because I'm learning so much about how each team functions. Most evenings I don't leave until after 8. But I've learned that in this office, and in this city, that's not so unusual. The Kessler Glenn wedding is the second week of December, and I'm sort of desperate to see it all come together. First of all, I've never worked a wedding with Selah, and I'm excited to see how she handles it. Also, the sketches Miko has shown me literally take my breath away. They're so pretty. Next week is the Riverton party, but that's the last event we have before Thanksgiving. The SSC office is closed Wednesday through Sunday that week, and I can't believe I get to spend 5 whole days at home. I plan on wearing sweatpants and eating my weight in starches and carbs. Snap, snap, snap. My head pops up from where it's buried in my laptop, researching transvestite DJs for an upcoming party. Apparently, they're all the rage. McKenna, as usual, isn't looking up at me, but he's holding out a post-it with an order for him and Quaid. I glance at the time on my laptop. It's only 11:45. That's early even for them. This doesn't bode well for me. I can just feel it. When I come back 20 minutes later, McKenna and Quaid are giggling, which is a fairly odd sound coming from such grouchy people. In another office, in another place, I'd ask what was so funny. I try and engage and befriend them both, but I've learned that these two don't see me as an equal and sure as heck don't want me as a friend. I hand them their drinks and sit down to get back to work. It's so true, McKenna says, still giggling. She's got to have gained at least 60 pounds, and she's not even due until February or something. Did you see her on Kimmel talking about her pregnancy cravings? Quaid asks while typing something into her phone. Oh, God, I know, so tragic, McKenna agrees. I realize now that they're talking about Paige Blakely. She's a new client of Selah's, and we're working on the shower for her first baby. Since she and her rock star baby daddy are still unmarried, Selah's hopeful that she'll also be asked to plan the rumored post-baby nuptials. Paige is a popular country singer, so you know I love her, but she's made some headlines lately for the amount of weight she's gained with her pregnancy. Personally, I think making fun of a pregnant woman's weight is downright evil, but being mean is nothing new for these two. Maybe they'll head out later and punch some babies for kicks. And you saw her email, right? She wants a duck-themed shower. What is this, 1987? You hire the most expensive event planner on Earth and then ask her for ducks? Piglets would have been more appropriate, McKenna chuckles again. And the barnyard theme might be a better fit for a country girl. Right, Brink? He spins around in his chair, presumably to mock me, too. But his eyes bug out of his head before they can focus on me. At McKenna's silence, Quaid turns in her chair, and her face turns even paler than it is already. Both of them stare in silence, and even though I'm hidden by the door, I want to crawl under the chair and cower from whatever is in the doorway. Finally, I hear the slightest clearing of a throat, and then Selah's voice. Paige and I were just headed down to lunch, and she wanted to see the office. She speaks with the menace of a snake. Paige, I'm so sorry you had to. McKenna tries to cover smoothly, and Quaid looks like she's about to be run over by a train. I guess on some level, she is. Selah cuts him off. No, you won't apologize. What you will do, both of you, is remove yourselves from my office. You don't work here anymore. If it's possible, Quaid becomes even more ashen. McKenna swallows audibly. It's like watching a car wreck and I literally can't look away. Brinkley? Selah calls out to me, and both Quaid and McKenna slide their eyes to me in the corner. I didn't even know she knew I was back here. Yes, ma'am? I step out from behind the door nervously. Selah is boiling mad, but she's doing her best to mask it in front of the very pregnant blonde country singer standing next to her. Will you walk Paige back out to the lounge? I'll be there momentarily. Of course, I say, walking forward. If you'll just follow me, Miss Blakely. Paige starts waddling through the office with a smile plastered on her face, but as she turns, I can see that her eyes are watery. She's the cutest little thing I've ever seen, in her brightly colored maxi dress and her wedge sandals and her big, bouncy blonde hair. She's short like me, so the added weight is even more noticeable, but she's still gorgeous and glowing. Screw those a-holes for making fun of her. Before I can think better of it, I say what I'm thinking. Miss Blakely, please excuse my language, but they're both total assholes. You look fantastic. She sniffs and looks up at me. It's okay. It's nothing I haven't heard before. She sniffs again. No, I'm shaking my head. It's not okay. They're idiots. They couldn't find their butt if they had both hands in their back pockets. I scowl. My mama always says that. Paige smiles her first real smile as we reach the lounge. Mine too, I smile back. Where are you from? She asks as she lowers herself slowly onto a sofa. West Texas. Half my family's from West Texas, she smiles sweetly. Whereabouts? And just like that, both of our accents are going in full force. Odessa? Of course I know Odessa. My granny's from Midland. When I was younger, we used to head into Odessa for this great barbecue place I loved. The Pit? I ask with a smile. The Pit! Lord, I haven't been there in ages, but I loved that place. She absently rubs her belly with one hand. Mama's gonna die when I tell her that Paige Blakely knows the Pit. Actually, that's my mom and daddy's place. She actually moans in response. I'm so jealous. One of my pregnancy fantasies is having unlimited access to brisket. She giggles. Before I can agree, I hear Selah behind me. Paige, just one more minute and we'll head down. Brinkley, a word? How long has she been standing there? I turn and follow her back behind the wall that separates reception from the rest of the office. At the far end of the room, I can see Quaid and McKenna packing up their desks. Oh no, she really has fired them. What does this mean for me? You're good with people. Selah says it like an accusation. I look up into her face, still strained in anger, and just nod. She lowers her voice. Presumably so Paige can't overhear. Quaid and McKenna were my entire support team, and they're gone. I don't allow anyone to insult my clientele, and they should know better. I think of all of the times I've listened to her insult her clientele. I guess it's only okay if none of them catch you doing it. I nod again. She gives me a quick head-to-toe perusal, and then her eyes narrow. I don't have the time or the inclination to spend the height of the holiday party season finding and training a new assistant. I need you to start immediately. I think I stare at her for a full 10 seconds before I find my voice to respond. I'm sorry, what? I ask in shock. The job, as my assistant, it's what you're working toward, right? If possible, she's even more annoyed. She looks down at the phone in her hand and starts to search through its contents. Yes, ma'am. I mean, of course. You can either do this job or you can't. Which is it? She snaps. It's exactly the same question McKenna asked me when he taught me to use the phone. I wonder now if Selah asked him the same question once. I can't believe any of this is happening. This morning I was excited about the prospect of watching The Bachelorette tonight on TV. And now Selah's offering me a job it should have taken years for me to acquire. She looks up from her phone, and I don't have time to debate it any longer. I decided when I came here that Sayla was a means to an end, and she's offering me a chance to get to that end far faster than I could have anticipated. I muster every ounce of confidence I've acquired in my 23 years, and I look her dead in the eye. I am strong. I am smart. I am courageous. I can. Good. She stares at me a beat longer, then looks back to her phone. I've told McKenna to leave the handbook out and any pertinent notes available for you. They should be gone within a quarter hour. I'm off with Paige for lunch, but I'll be back by 4. Tell Taylor I want the revised rental order on my desk by then, and make sure it's printed out. I don't like looking at those line items on a screen. And then she's gone. I turn slowly on my heel and see Miko staring, her eyes twice as big as they normally are. Before I can even get to her, Quaid and McKenna come out of the small office with their stuff, looking annoyed but confident. Neither of them acknowledges anyone. It's as if their colleagues are somehow responsible for all of this. They start to pass me, and as usual, I'm not smart enough to keep my mouth shut. I'm sorry, guys. McKenna stops mid-step and glares at me, his angry face daring me to say another word. Then he resumes walking, and they both carry on, refusing to look at me. How embarrassing for them. I wonder what they'll do now. What kind of reference would Sayla give them? I don't even have time to contemplate it because I can hear Sayla's phone buzzing, and I'm apparently the person who answers that now. I hurry past the room that's come to a standstill with all of this drama, past Miko's confused expression, and into the little office that's now all mine. I sit down at McKenna's desk and put in the earpiece as I punch the button for line 1. Sayla Smith's office, I chirp, but the caller is already hung up. I look down at the white desk and see a thick black binder with the title SSE Assistant Handbook, and right next to it is a bright post-it. I realize it's the note Sayla asked him to write, the one with any pertinent information I should have. McKenna's serial killer handwriting is scribbled furiously across the top. You won't last the week, Texas. Well, at least this time he got the state right. While Sayla is at her lunch meeting, I do my level best to memorize the assistant binder. It's something like 52 pages single-spaced, and mostly includes info about how to properly format an email and answer the phone. But it's a lifeline, and I'm clinging to it with both hands. The phone is quiet through most of the afternoon, and while I'm thankful for the reprieve, there's something ominous about the silence. I'm guessing that the rumor of the Volturi's untimely demise has quickly made the rounds throughout the event industry, and that none of the vendors want to risk speaking with Sayla when there's already blood in the water. Brinkley, my office. Sayla's clipped tone whips into my little room and my head snaps up. She's already passed by, not bothering to confirm that I've heard her, just confident that her request will be met. I hurry to follow her with a notepad at the ready. I walk just inside the door of her office and pause, waiting for her next command. Close the door and take a seat, she says without looking up from the screen of her cell phone. I do as I'm told. Sayla angrily jabs a few buttons on the phone and then puts it down on her desk. Her eyes narrow on me like a hawk. I don't have time for this, she barks. I'm sorry, should I come back later? I'm confused. I've had Quaid for almost 2 years, and McKenna for half that. I don't know how I'm expected to continue at this level without proper support. Her tone is accusatory, as if I'm the one who's done something wrong. I just stare at her and try not to show how nervous I am. When I don't reply, she plows ahead. Whatever you don't know, you need to figure out. I have zero idea what she's talking about, but as McKenna has taught me to do, I nod anyway. Sayla pointedly glares down at the notebook in my hands. Since it's clear she wants me to make a note, I write, number 1, figure out whatever I don't know. Next, the all-hands meeting is tomorrow morning. I shouldn't have to remind you of this. That's your responsibility now. I continue to write notes, but my stomach just drops out. I'm supposed to run a meeting? Like a real one? The last meeting I led was back in Girl Scouts. Also, Margot emailed last week about some brunch or something she wants to do. We'll need to talk to Jen about the pool she's done for that. Production should have 3 proposals going out today. Confirm their delivery. I have drinks tonight with a team from Haiku, but I'm exhausted. This day is for shit. I need to reschedule. Make an appointment with the acupuncturist, my shoulders are too tense, and switch my Pilates back to Friday. She keeps listing things in rapid fire, and I scribble furiously without comment. 30 minutes later, I'm dismissed, and it takes everything in me not to sag with relief. I hope that I've filled up 5 pages of notes because I'm new at this, and not because this is typical for a random Selah weekday. I'm just barely at the door when Selah calls out again. And Brinkley? I turn around with a pageant contestant smile on my face. This? She points her index finger at my hair, then sweeps it around to encompass my face. Is ridiculous. The aesthetic here is chic, not cheap. You're a representation of my brand now, and as such, I expect you to look presentable. I will not cry. I will not cry. I won't cry, but I don't trust myself to speak. I simply nod and turn to leave the room. I walk back into the little office without looking at anyone else. Once inside, I sit down with my back to the door and fight to see the computer screen through the tears in my eyes. When I hear Selah's door open, I quickly dab at the tears with my sleeve and pray to God that none of my mascara is running. Brinkley, I'm headed out. I won't be back today, but I'm available on email. I swivel around to speak to her, but she's already walked off. I'm still staring at the empty doorway when Miko bursts through it and closes it quickly behind her. What the hell? I'm her new assistant? I meant that as a statement. And that's what you want? She asks, serious. Yeah, yes. That's what I've always wanted. I just thought it would come when I was actually prepared to do the job. I haven't really done any of this yet. Defeated, I wave my hands desperately around the small office and then let them plop into my lap. And I have all these notes from her, but I don't know who half these people are or what she's talking about. I grab a hold of my notepad and wave it at Miko spastically. The defeat I felt just minutes ago was slowly turning into panic. I mean, I can figure out just about anything, and I can usually handle whatever anyone wants to throw my way. But I'm so far out of my league with her, I'll never catch up. And if I can't figure it out, she's not going to let me stay, and I... Okay, hold on. Miko looks at me sternly, waits to make sure I am in fact holding on, and then abruptly leaves the office. She walks back through the door 40 seconds later and puts something into my hands. First, eat this. It'll help, she says. I blink down at my hands. Fig Newtons? I look up at her, dismayed. It's the only sugar I have at my desk. I wasn't anticipating a crisis today or I'd be better prepared. Just eat it. I'll be right back. She leaves and I look back down at the little package of cookies. Well, can't hurt. I'm on the second cookie when Miko comes back with Holt in tow. I don't really know Holt well. She mostly works on PR and marketing for SSE, so I haven't interacted with her much. She's a really pretty blonde, but she seems perpetually annoyed. Right now is no exception. Miko pulls the angry Barbie through the office door and then closes it behind them. Brinkley, this is Holt. Holt's going to be super helpful and answer any questions you have about this new job of yours. Miko eyeballs her companion, silently daring her to disagree. My eyes fly to my new savior. Oh my gosh, really? What can you tell me? I squeak. Everything. Holt sounds exasperated, but she takes Quade's old seat. How do you know so much? I ask, curious. I'm the one who wrote that. Holt points to the manual on my desk and my eyes bug out. You were Selah's assistant? The very first, she says, and I can't tell if the bitterness in her voice is from having to talk to me or the memory of what it meant to blaze that particular trail. Oh man, this is so awesome. I had no idea any former assistant still worked here. Maybe I'm not going to get fired after all. And you don't mind helping me out? Holt eyes Miko speculatively, and then finally says, Actually, yes. I have about 1,000 other things to do, and as I pointed out to Jen, no one taught me how to do this job. I just figured it out. And as Jen pointed out to you, Miko sounds patronizing, that was back when this company was much smaller and the job description not nearly so intense. Holt opens her mouth to argue further, but Miko holds her hand up. I also pointed out to Holt that were she unable to assist you with this, it might be difficult for my design team to keep working on all the marketing materials that continue to make her look so good at her job. Isn't that right, Holt? Miko asks with mock sweetness. Holt allows herself a 30-second death stare, but she must really need Miko's help because she turns to me with a bland expression. Let's start with personal assistant work. That's what's going to make you want to slit your wrists the most, so you may as well know what you're in for. I look at Miko and then back at Holt. Apparently, she's not joking. I grab the notepad off my desk and spin back around. Tell me everything. My voice sounds a lot more confident than I actually feel. Chapter 8. I worked until 10 trying to cram as much information as I could into my brain while Sayla wasn't in the office to harass me. This morning I spend 45 minutes in front of my closet trying to pick out an outfit that she won't find ridiculous. I settle for a black Zara jumper over black tights and black-heeled booties. The little black blazer I've got on is a recent acquisition from a shopping trip into Miko's closet. Since she owns more clothes than any single human I've ever met, she's more than willing to let me swipe a few pieces. I've toned down my hair and makeup as requested, though I have to tell you, I feel totally naked without my lashes. My one act of defiance is a thin, neon pink patent leather belt around my waist. I've decided that if Sayla makes any comment about it, I'll use it to strangle her. I'm the first one in the conference room for the all-hands meeting, and as the space slowly starts to fill up, I review my notes for the 50th time. Everyone glances at me surreptitiously as they make their way to their seats, but no one says anything. I'm sure they're all just dying to see how many ways the intern can screw this one up. Someone takes the seat next to mine, and I look up to see Miko sliding a Starbucks cup to me with a smile. What kind of coffee is this? I ask. The don't piss your big girl pants kind, she says with a grin. I take a sip of the caramel latte and smile back. Sayla chooses that moment to breeze into the room, and my stomach seriously considers rejecting the sip of latte, but I keep it in check. I am strong. I am smart. I am courageous. I am strong. I am smart. I am courageous. I plaster a smile on my face, and we all wait while she finishes typing on her phone. After a few minutes of nervously staring at my boss, I look around the room at all the faces waiting anxiously along with me. It only then occurs to me, this is just another one of her intimidation techniques. She loves that a whole room of adults sits watching her like an audience. In fact, if this is anything like the other meetings I've been to, she'll look for any and every opportunity to embarrass me or put me in my place. I will not let her have the satisfaction of catching me unaware. I watch her facial features like a hawk, and the second I see her mouth open to say something, I spring to my feet. Should we get started then? I ask quickly. For a second, she just stares at me, and everyone else does too. I didn't wait for her to call on me. But she was about to do just that, and everyone knows it. It's not like she can chew me out for doing my job. Can she? By all means. She waves at me impatiently. The Riverton party is coming up next Tuesday. Taylor, would you give us a production status, please? I say it with a smile that only slightly wobbles. Taylor looks at me bemused. Guest list is confirmed at 287. Rental's coming in Monday afternoon. Finalizing the DJ's rider and the special VIP section for the Riverton team. How many of that total are VIPs? Sayla asks Taylor. Taylor looks to Walker, who consults her notes. But I have the information, so I just jump in. 33 are VIPs, 14 of those are SSE clients. You mentioned you'd double confirm arrival times with PR on Monday, correct, Walker? I ask down the table. 16 sets of eyes are staring at me in open shock. And believe me, no one is more surprised by the confidence in my tone than I am. But here's the thing. Last night, while I lay under my purple comforter and vacillated between excitement about this opportunity and open panic that I'd be fired before lunchtime, I finally made a decision. I decided that if I was going to do this job, I was going to have the courage to do it to the best of my abilities. That way, if Sayla decides to can me, at least I will know I've tried my best. Just do your best. I hear Mama say in the back of my mind. And so that's what I'm doing. That is correct, isn't it? I ask again when no one answers. Yes, that's correct. Walker agrees quickly. Carpet arrivals start when? Sayla asks the production team. 8, I answer again. Maybe I'd know that if I had the timeline. I finish Selah's sentence, pointing to the iPad I had turned on and placed before her at the beginning of the meeting. The timeline for the Riverton event is open on the screen. Well, aren't you just full of surprises? Selah says. I choose to take that as a compliment, regardless of whether she is offering one. I smile at her, waiting for instruction. Selah scans the timeline, then looks up at Taylor. Did we get the cigar guy for Diego? Of course. According to him, he's born and raised in Havana. Can't get any more authentic than that, Taylor says. And he's set up where? Next to the Riverton sampling table in the VIP lounge, he replies. And that is where, exactly. Honestly, Taylor, how am I supposed to know what that means? She snaps at him. I slide the party diagram from my stack of paperwork out where she can look it over. Look at me, everyone. I'm Johnny on the spot. Selah studies it for a moment and then looks up again. I want to change the VIP seating around. Jen, you and I can discuss that later. Miko nods at her, and Selah continues. I don't think I need to remind everyone how important this client is. The tequila line is Diego's baby. But Riverton Spirits has multiple liquor brands and incredibly deep pockets. Every element has to be beyond reproach. She glares up and down the table and everyone nods quickly to appease her. At last she asks, All right, what's next, Brinkley? I'm so thrilled having made it out of my first all-hands meeting in one piece, I don't even mind when Selah barks for her coffee later that afternoon. I ask Ambrose to cover the phones and hurry out to grab the order. When I bring it back to the office, her door is closed, and I knock quietly. She calls for me to enter, but as I open the door, I can hear that she's on a call. I try and stay as quiet as possible as I walk across the room. I understand your interest, Meryl, she says into the phone without looking up. I mean, obviously, I've only ever hired the best, but that no longer includes Will McKenna. I almost trip over my shoes when I realize she's talking about McKenna and Quaid. I need to get out of this room as quickly as possible. I set down the coffee cup and see her eyes flash as she listens to what the person on the other end of the line is saying. Of course. Well, ultimately, it's your decision. But I have to tell you, I'd have real issues associating with any company who'd be willing to work with someone I've had to let go. Her tone is sharp and serious. And I hope she doesn't call out to me before I get to the door. No, I do mean it. I'd hate to stop sending you business, but really, you'd be forcing my hand if you brought him on. My trust has been broken. And once that happens, I'm afraid I just don't feel comfortable working with a company who employs... Oh, you do? I'm so glad to hear it. I'd hate to lose you as a partner, Mare. She's back to using her sweet client voice again. Happy with the response the person on the phone is given. I close the door quickly behind me and head back to my office. I'm trying to process what I've just heard. I'm pretty sure she was talking to Meryl Franklin, who owns the event rental company we use most often, and that Meryl was considering hiring McKenna. Clearly, Selah has stopped it from happening. Plus, Selah has just let Meryl, one of the biggest gossips in this industry, know that she won't do business with anyone who does hire either McKenna or Quaid. Selah's connections and budgets are big and deep. I can't imagine any vendor in town is willing to cross her. So she's effectively just signed the death certificates of her former assistants' event careers. I can never, ever cross this woman.
We need alcohol!
Miko yells down the bar to Max, who is clearly busy with another customer as we walk up to the bar. I'm pretty sure she blackballed them. I continue the conversation we'd started in the car. It wouldn't be the first time. Miko reaches for the happy hour menu, even though we surely have it memorized by now. You mean she's done this before? I'm shocked. A cute hipster bartender walks up to us. What can I get you, ladies? He asks, in what I'm guessing is his most alluring voice. Miko waves him away dismissively with the menu in her hand. Nope, not you! She doesn't react at all to his startled expression, but I give him an apologetic look as he scoots away. Of course she's done it before. Salif's friendships and the power with which she wields them are a thing of beauty. If there's a bitchy, well-connected publicist in a 100-mile radius, you can bet Salif will be her maid of honor when she gets hitched to whatever junior development exec she convinces to marry her without a prenup. I don't understand. What do Salif's friends have to do with anything? Mika looks at me like she can't believe I'd ask such an idiotic question. Everything. Sayla is besties with every a-hole publicist in town because they're the ones who bring her their biggest clients. Big clients mean big budgets and therefore a lot of power where vendors are concerned. Nobody's going to mess with her and she knows it. She yells again.
Max, come on, did you hear me? We need a drink. She survived the day!
Max scowls at her but comes down to us all the same. Did you hear? Miko asks, excited. That you need alcohol? Max asks.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure everyone north of Sunset heard that.
Yes, alcohol. We're celebrating. She survived! In the nearly 2 months we've been hanging out, Miko, bless her heart, has blatantly refused to acknowledge Max's bad moods. She simply carries on as if my roommate isn't glaring at her.
So you're still employed? Max asks.
Come on now. Miko does a little snap, whistle, and move it along, rolling of her finger. You can work while you chat, barkeep.
Max glowers, but dutifully starts to mix up something for us.
I'm still employed, and get this. They're paying me now.
I'm being sarcastic.
Hourly rate or salary?
Max adds some odds and ends to her cocktail shaker.
Salary, I answer proudly. Did you just put mint and tomatoes in that?
I eyeball the shaker skeptically.
Do you want to make the drinks?
Max stops using her pestle to grind the ingredients in the shaker.
Miko elbows me in the ribs.
Don't poke the bear, Landon.
I smile sheepishly at Max until she resumes making the drink.
We're all salary, by the way, Miko adds, eagerly reaching for the lowball glass Max passes her way.
Really? That seems so expensive.
I sniff my cocktail and then take a sip. The heady, sweet, and sour combination swims all the way down to my toes.
This is delicious. It's sort of like a tomato mojito.
That's what I was going for.
Max shrugs. Expensive would be if she actually had to pay us for all of our overtime. Salary only seems exciting until you realize how many hours you're working. I'd suggest never actually doing the math on what your hourly rate ends up being at the end of an event week. It'll only depress you.
Miko takes her first tentative sip of the drink. Her face lights up and she takes another huge swallow.
You're a wizard, she pronounces to Max.
Glad you think so. Max gives her a little smile and then turns her head to take someone else's order.
And now a toast!
Miko turns to me with her glass already raised.
To surviving day one.
To day one, I clink glasses with her.
Now, you just have to make it through 364 more of them, she says solemnly.
I look at her, she looks at me, and then she turns her head to Max. Raising her glass, she announces,
we're gonna need more of these!
Chapter 9. I drive up and down Sunset 3 times before I realize that 25, the location for the Riverton party, is the 2-story brick building half covered with ivy on the corner. In my defense, the only signage is a small silver XXV next to the door, and I don't realize they are Roman numerals until my 3rd time passed. I park around back and make my way to the rear door where several members of our production team are scurrying in and out. The Riverton party is supposed to be hip Hollywood luxury, and I tried to dress the part. I splurged on a pair of leather leggings with my first paycheck. They're sort of ridiculously expensive, but honestly, anything that makes my butt look this good might be worth twice as much. The leggings are tucked down inside ridiculously high-heeled boots that come up to just above my knees. My top is a blousy black silk that ties into a big bow around my neck. Sort of chic librarian. My hair is teased within an inch of its life and pulled back into a perfectly messy pony. And my one pop of color is a deep berry lip stain. At the last minute, I'd added a few lashes. Sayla might think they are ridiculous, but the Texan in me can't imagine going to a party without them.
I think my whole look is a good mashup of LA cool meets conservative Southern girl. Here's hoping I don't look like an idiot.
As I come through the back door of the club, I see Taylor looking over some paperwork in his hands.
He is as good a place to start as any.
How's everything going? I ask as I walk down the hallway towards him.
He looks up with a smile already on his face.
It's going just fine. Want a quick walkthrough?
That'd be great, thanks.
I haul my big bag higher up on my shoulder and fight to keep the weight from sliding back down my arm as we head towards the front of the club.
Taylor notices me fighting with it and gestures towards it with the paperwork rolled in his hand.
Can I help you with that?
Thanks, but I'll manage.
I smile at his manners, which only furthers my belief that he's from the South.
I'm dying to know whether or not that's an accent I detect.
Taylor's face spreads into a boyish grin, at complete odds with his rough-looking exterior.
Now here I thought it wasn't even noticeable anymore.
Well, maybe not to everyone else, but I'd recognize a native at 10 paces.
I eye him speculatively.
I'm guessing...
Oklahoma?
Born and bred.
You a cowboy?
He smiles lazily.
I'm a Sooner.
My scowl makes him laugh.
You?
Lone Star State.
Makes sense.
He nods thoughtfully.
And what's that supposed to mean?
He looks at me out of the corner of his eye.
You're far too polite to be anything but a good Southern girl.
Are you teasing me?
Of course not,
he says in a serious tone.
I love Southern girls.
Oh, I'm sure you do, I answer sarcastically.
We come to a fork in the road, and I'm unsure of which direction to turn.
I look to him.
You've never been to 25?
He points to the left.
With every step we take, the deep bass of the club's sound system rumbles louder.
I thought everyone on staff came here. It's got one of the toughest doors in L.A., but the SSE connection makes it easy to get on the list.
He has to raise his voice a little louder as we pass through an industrial kitchen bustling with food prep.
To be honest, all I've done since I moved to town is work and sleep. I haven't really had time to go out.
I pick my way slowly over the huge rubber mats that line the floor to keep people from slipping.
If I'm not careful, my heel's going to get stuck in one of these little grooves and kamikaze me to the floor.
Taylor stops and spins around abruptly. I nearly run into his tight black t-shirt that covers his, upon closer inspection, really defined chest.
Maybe you'll let me remedy that sometime.
He smiles down at me with a sly grin.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm flustered.
You're never going out.
I'd like to remedy that.
Oh, sure. Maybe we can all do happy hour after work or something,
I say dumbly.
I'm not really good at this sort of thing, and definitely not with someone who looks like he does.
Also, I'm pretty sure my daddy would have a heart attack if he saw all those tats, Southern or not.
He must see the distress written on my face, because he smiles, and it's not flirtatious, just friendly.
I promise I'm not nearly as dangerous as I look. I just thought we could hang out. Doesn't have to be drinks, it can be something totally harmless.
Okay, I answer unsure.
We finally find ourselves in the main room of the club, and all other thoughts flit from my mind because I can't stop gaping at the club space around me. 25 is a perfect mix of masculine, old-world furnishings and whimsical touches. The club is big, but not overwhelming. Everything from the bar to the second-floor lounges flows together, but each area is divided into sections throughout the space, and each feels slightly different, yet somehow all part of a whole. One section is a cluster of dark leather chaises and fur throws, and another looks like an old library in dark amber tones. The bar, an island in the middle of the room, is a mix of modern LED lights and old wood. In each space, the severity of the furnishings is muted by odd touches. A vintage brass scuba mask on a coffee table, a mountain goat bust mounted on exposed brick, huge oversized black and white pictures of cows covering the expanse of one wall. None of it makes any sense together, and yet it totally works. It's all mix-and-match luxury, the sort of space that makes you feel comfortable, even though the sofa you're sitting on surely costs more than your life is worth. I love it. Three guys from the production team come through the room carrying equipment to set up for the red carpet out front. They stop when they get close to us, and I see them give me a sleazy once-over. The look is bad enough, but then one of them decides to add soundtrack.
Damn, look who's all grown up!
His eyes run all the way down my body and back up again. Back when I was a waitress, I had to deal with this sort of thing all the time. But I'm unsure what I can say in this situation. Is this normal LA work behavior? Before I can respond, Taylor does it for me.
Well, now that's appropriate, he says with sarcasm. You guys get back to work.
He's at least 10 years younger than all of them, but they obey without hesitation and walk away.
Sorry about that. Smith's actually not a bad guy. He's just trapped in the body of an 11-year-old.
Awkward silence descends, and I want to change the subject. How much of this decor did we bring in? I run a hand over the top of an ancient-looking pool table that's been reupholstered in bright purple velvet.
Decor? Taylor looks confused.
Nothing. We only brought in some extra lounges for seating. You really haven't been out in LA, have you?
Why do you say that?
I look back at him.
Because this is a Barker Ash property.
Barker Ash as in the hotel chain?
Barker Ash as in the everything. Hotels, restaurants, a handful of the best clubs in town.
That bemused expression is back. It's like I'm some sort of Martian who needs him to explain the intricacies of Earth life.
Okay, but what does that have to do with the decor? I ask slowly.
Each Barker Ash property has a similar aesthetic. It's our signature design. A man speaks up from behind us. I turn around to acknowledge him, and the look on my face, a smile, a mask of horror, I have no idea, freezes in place. Brody Ashton, gorgeous, uptight, and apparently wealthy owner of this club, is standing in front of me looking like the cover of GQ. Next to Brody is a beautiful woman who's nearly as gorgeous looking as he is. Her long, dark hair is sleek, shiny perfection, and I'm pretty sure just her legs alone are taller than I am. She's dressed for something far fancier than our event tonight, which makes me wonder what they're doing here now, especially way before the party starts. Brody is in dark wool slacks with a blue button-down under a dark gray vest. His sleeves are rolled and pushed up on his tan forearms, and his hair is way past the need for a cut, but still looks all rumpled, bedhead perfection. I'm not sure how someone can look simultaneously casual, sexy, stoic businessman, but he's somehow cornered the market. I have a small moment of panic that he and his girl Friday might have just seen the creepy sleazy interaction with the production guy, but she looks too bored to care, and his face is entirely unreadable. He leans over and whispers something into her ear, and she nods and heads off towards the bar. I can't stop staring at them. They're both beautiful in a way I thought was achievable only through airbrushing.
Do you like what you see?
He asks.
Oh, Lord, he caught me staring. I'm pretty sure I just swallowed my tongue.
Excuse me? I squeak when I'm able to produce sound again. He frowns slightly, like I'm an idiot or a waste of time or both.
The club aesthetic. Do you like what you see? Does everything look okay for the event?
I mumble eloquently. Taylor saves me.
You heard about the issues with the alarm?
Yeah, Bennett, thanks for calling. I was on my way out and thought I'd stop by to check on it.
Brody reaches out and shakes his hand.
There shouldn't be any other problems, but Marco is on site if you need anything. Since I'm here, though, can I just confirm that guest count again?
I think we're at 215 or something like that, Taylor replies quickly.
Brody inspects us both, like he doesn't believe what Taylor's saying, and he's wise not to. Our guest count was at 301 as of this morning.
I've told Selah this, but I'll just remind you again. Capacity is 250, and that includes staff. I won't do battle with Fire Marshal again over her numbers.
Brody's face is calm, but his tone leaves no room for discussion. He does not seem like someone you'd want to piss off.
Taylor must agree because he nods emphatically.
Absolutely. Totally understand.
Well, I'll leave you both to it.
Without another word, Brody turns and heads back, presumably to find his date.
We're room ready in an hour, Brinks. You still want me to show you the layout? Taylor says to me.
Brinks?
I blink at him.
What am I, an armored truck?
Sure, yeah, show me everything.
I'm checking things off the list on the clipboard when Selah pours into the club 45 minutes later with a group of impeccably dressed men all around her. I attach the pin to the edge of the clipboard and walk over to meet them. She doesn't acknowledge me, but I'm not dumb enough to leave her presence without permission. At every event I've worked so far,
Quaid never left Selah's side for 1 minute. I've wondered what would happen if she had to use the restroom. I guess tonight I'm going to find out. I stand off to the side as Selah walks the clients through the room. Diego.